Hi, thanks for joining us. This is Kira, and I'm here today with Tommy Smith, playwright for DB, which is having its world premiere now at the Coho Theater, and we'll be playing through February 4th. And we have the chance to sit down with Tommy and talk about DB, this play, and his obsession with the story. So we are sitting here on this beautiful set, and we're just going to dive right in, Tommy, to your thoughts on this set.
The set sort of reminds me of my memories of being a kid. You know, like, this, I grew up in tattered versions of all this, and these are new versions. You know, those seats over there are basically, pretty much unused, or in, at least in very good condition for them being seats from 1976, so 2 years, those are 2 years older than me, those seats. And just, like, the artifacts of the show, I think, are really, really help everyone find their place and find the setting, because we don't want to bog people down with exposition.
Right.
And so the designers put a lot of work into making sure iconic things show up on stage so that we automatically know that we're in 1971. And we have the ads in the show and all
right,
that stuff.
So you know exactly where you are.
Yeah, exactly.
Which was one of the things that I wanted to ask you, was your personal connection to the story of DB and how it relates to your childhood. Because I know you've said you grew up being a DB enthusiast and kind of what this place setting means to you and how you became obsessed or at least intrigued by the story.
Well, I think everyone at the time was obsessed by it. I think nationally, he became a folk hero so quickly that by the time that I gained sentience around, you know, I was born in 78, but I was sentient probably at like 81, 82. It was one of the first things I picked up on living here and being alive in the Northwest, was maybe even from, I'd say, like 6 or 7, When I could conceive of He-Man as a hero, I could also conceive of D.B. Cooper as this anti-hero. And I've said this in some other forms in the program notes.
Right.
But, you know, in the woods of Washington, when you're a kid and you're in the back seat and you're driving past all these trees, in the woods are two things. You imagine two things. You imagine Sasquatch. You imagine him kind of lumbering past with his arms in that one video, past tree trunks, and you imagine D.B. Cooper. And D.B. Cooper is this guy scurrying around in a Johnny Cash suit with $200,000. And that, just the image of that, this like man running through the forest with all this money, and that he could be in my forests, the ones that were directly around my house, was somehow just like really fascinating. It was like, you know, the wood sprites in Lord of the Rings, sort of like that there are, that the further you go into the woods, there are deeper and stranger mythologies than exist in the town. And that, I've always lived on the cusp of that in my own life. And in, we sort of lived on the edge of a town, and the town was buttressed on a huge forest that just still goes on for miles and miles and miles. But you drive one direction, and 10 minutes you're in Tacoma, or 15 minutes you're in Tacoma. So that sort of like mental dichotomy between the city, which is very structured thinking, and then the woods, which is just, you know, D.B. Cooper and Sasquatch are, you know, running around, you know, having tea with each other. Like, I think that they represent two states of mind often are at war with inside everybody.
So do you think D.B. Cooper is maybe our connection between those two worlds? Because Sasquatch, right, is he's a mythological creature. Mm-hmm. But D.B. Cooper was one of us. And by doing this, you know, deed, participating in this mystery, he became a legend. Do you think that's part of the appeal? If D.B. Cooper can cross that line from the structured world to the magic world, maybe we all can.
Absolutely. Because it's on a lot of levels the story of Jesus. It's a man who a few people see, and the witness that they have of him becomes this mythology that then, you know, guides people like the Donnie Darko chest wand, you know, that sort of, that you become, the spirit of D.B. Cooper can be inside of you as well. But, you know, mostly how that manifests is you're a libertarian and you don't like how the government is structured.
Right.
So you look at this probable Vietnam vet who, you know, screwed over the Fed out of $200,000, actually a low amount, pretty much just to show that he could do it and jump out of the back of the plane and get away with it.
Right. It was more of a middle finger than anything else.
Exactly. That's going to fuel your vote for Trump.
Right.
That is going to put your finger to tick off that box or to make that comment on the website or to, you know, I think the legacy of D.B. Cooper, because he didn't have a motive, is a dangerous one, actually, because it's actually not something to romanticize.
Right. He's like Robin Hood.
Yeah.
But he just takes and doesn't necessarily give to the poor.
And in fact...
So where does that leave us?
Exactly. And in fact, terrorized the people that literally... He was, let's not mince words, he was a terrorist. He terrorized the people that knew about him. The people on the ground, the stewardesses, the pilots. It was not a victimless crime. And because, you know, in the year after DB jumped out of the plane, there was something like, I don't know, hundreds of copycats after that. And then and then the legacy of that goes all the way to 9/11. You know, those guys would have never have done that had DB Cooper not done his first.
Wow, do you really think that? You can draw that direct line?
Absolutely. I mean, you can make the case that someone would have done it, but I don't think there's just something about that he was really the first one to get away with it and to see how it mushroomed from there and also to see how the federal government reacted by clamping down. I mean, you didn't even have to show an ID to get on a flight before DB. You just had to sign your name and give $20 cash. You could sign, I could assign Johnny Cash, you know, I could sign Kira Coughlin and it would be fine, you know? So, maybe not Kira Coughlin because, you know, the gender thing, but yeah, I mean, I feel like that there's, you know, I'm not going to go hardline on that connection, but I think that you can definitely say that, you know, there's that Tolstoy quote, you can't renew an illusion that you have once seen through. And I think the illusion of safety in air travel is the one that DB just, he pulled the veil away and everyone was, he made the world see that these are bombs flying through the air, basically.
Right. And that, yeah, that's something that we can't unsee, and especially now in our day and age, which is another thing that I thought was really interesting, is that even in our age of extreme fear around terrorism, D.B. Cooper remains, to so many people, an anti-hero, but someone that they look up to or provide something valuable, right? The legend of D.B. Cooper provides something valuable to the people who are obsessed with it. And where do you think that comes from?
Well, what do you think that they find valuable in it?
I think they find the mystery valuable. I think in a world where we are constantly under surveillance and everything we do is trackable, that there's a part of the human soul that loves the mystery and that maybe we're willing to sacrifice, you know, sacrifice a few innocent victims for a good story.
Sure, sure. I think that you know, the guy who is the central character in the nonfiction book Into the Wild.
Yes.
That hippie kid who went off into the wilderness and died.
Yeah.
He did the same thing. He went off the grid.
Right.
And disappeared. But there isn't a groundswell around spreading his message, unless you're Sean Penn. And his journey is rightfully seen as both something to admire and something to never, ever, ever do.
Do, right, exactly.
Never do it. But D.B. Cooper's isn't seen that way. There isn't that other side that looks at the history of air terrorism and sees him at the genesis of the family tree of it.
Right.
You know, there isn't, when someone's like, oh, it's great, he got away with this, they're not thinking about that side. And I think it's actually important to look at the other side, the shadow side of the myth of him. You know?
Sure. Is that part of what urged you to write this play?
I think, you know, I kept thinking about Tina Mucklow, who's the stewardess.
Right.
The only person who actually saw him.
Right.
Ever in the history of mankind, humankind. And I wanted, there's something about, actually, the mystery that you're talking mm-hmm. about, the fascination, isn't with DB, it's with her.
Interesting.
Because I think about what's locked in her mind and will never come out. You know, she went into a convent after the skyjacking.
Wow.
And then she disappeared from the convent. So her disappearance is way more interesting to me because there was something about the shock of both helping this man and being witness to it and asked to be this keyhole in
right.
through which we see him, that was too much for her. And she had to go away from everyone for the rest of her life, for eternity, essentially.
Yeah.
Because she didn't want to reveal. Because who knows, really? I think it's just... I think she really was just Catholic and wanted to have a job, wanted to have a normal existence, and this thing came in and completely shoved her off course. I think that that's closer to an American myth that we all identify with, rather than D.B. D.B. Cooper is the one that we want to be, but who we actually are is Tina Mucklow, you know?
Right.
We want to have our life go one way, and a horrible tragedy comes in, and it irrevocably changes us, and we either crush under it, or we thrive. But most of us get crushed under it. And
right.
I think that that's the value. To see that in a macrocosm of a play, to have your own drama be played out against this skyjacking, I think is what I want the audience to kind of, the emotional experience of that.
So is this play really about Tina?
Well, it's really about me, but it is really about Tina. I mean, that's the thing. Tina is the, I was talking about it with... this really great Portland actress Val Landrum earlier today. We were talking about mm-hmm. just because she was in the development of it. And Tina's actually a side character who becomes the main character of the
right.
play. It's actually about her, but there's this kind of fade shift to her, that the play is trying to find a main character, and then we keep finding out that each of the main characters are imposters, and then we drop it, and then another one inhabits the DB role. We
right.
drop that one, and another one inhabits a DB role, and we realize that we're not actually following... We've also been following the experience of the stewardess the entire time as these different actors inhabit the role of DB Cooper. So I like how it works, and we only really got it in the last, like, 2 days. My last rewrite
right.
came, like, 2 days before that. You know, Isaac left me, like, a 6-minute voice message detailing why this last scene needed to change, and I sat and I thought about it for a sec, and then I called him and I just said, yeah, make that change. You know?
Yeah.
So, but that's the fun thing about being able to work on a play in this level, you know, to be, have everyone on their feet and able to understand that all this intellectual stuff that we've been talking about for 9 months can actually filter into these last minute quick changes of script and everyone go, yeah, that feels right. Rather than continually mull over stuff as I have been for the last 4 years with this play.
Right. Yeah. So that was another thing I wanted to go back to, was kind of the collaborative process
yep.
that this particular staging has been. And you have a co-creator,
uh-huh.
right? Teddy Bergman. And then Isaac, you said, you know, was kind of like suggesting rewrites up till the last minute. So how do you think that process went, and how do you usually work?
This is the start of a different way of working for me. Because I realize that a lot of screenplays are, the story is often co-written
mm-hmm.
and then somebody writes the actual scenes in the text. And I just was wondering why playwrights don't do that more, because I think what American playwrights specifically are trained at is being very emotionally intelligent, which was the training that I got at Juilliard.
Mm-hmm.
But we are not taught structure in any sort of formal way. Like a British playwright knows how to move a story like it's the back of their hand, you know, but we don't really get that. And so what I brought Teddy in to do, and it occurred naturally out of us talking about this project, was
right.
I knew that if I did the research myself as the writer, that the research would show up in the writing, which is why like every third play that you watch seems like a full-length Facebook page or a full-length Wikipedia entry, is because the writer is a little too close to the material. And I felt this before in plays where I was dealing with writing Sloan commissions about science and,
right.
and whatnot. So what I got Teddy to do was he did all the primary research on DB, and then he would feed me a scene. He would say, this is a scene between a man who needs medication and a wife who wants to give it to him and the man resisting, right? That scene.
Right.
And it would be that section of the narrative that Dwayne, his wife is trying to get him to take medication, you know,
right.
It's part of the actual historically correct story. But he would abstract it and just give me the bare bones of the scene. And so I mean, there is a 3.5-hour version of this play that
wow.
is just so boring because I just kitchen sinked it with
right.
everything that I could write. And,
right.
and we went through a couple workshop processes in New York with Woodshed Collective,
mm-hmm.
Page 73 Productions, the Vineyard the project on Martha's Vineyard, and it's just, we've just gone through the ACT Theater in Seattle. We've just gone through tons of drafts of it. And I think the like watertight, unassailable nature of the script right now is due to the 150 people who worked on it over the course of the last 4 years, you know, and you can't just write a play in a vacuum, you know, and this
right.
play in particular. And so Teddy was very instrumental in keeping me away from the research and also keeping me on task with the story. And then Isaac, the director, just came in as part of us developing the show at Portland Center Stage at JAW. He was an actor.
Right.
And then he just got interested in it, and he was like, I want to do it here. And it just seemed right, you know, to do it in Portland, because this is where he took off from, you know.
Right, so. Right. So it's a local legend, both for the characters and also for you,
yeah.
right? Because you grew up in the Pacific Northwest. So this is a homecoming of sorts.
Yeah.
Great. So what are you working on next?
I'm neck deep in screenplay option land, and so I am working on a horror film option. I'm doing a video piece called Arizona at IRT Theater. I'm also working on a commission about the guy who invented LSD for EST Theater, Ensemble Studio Theater in New York, and that's the one that I'm going to be primarily writing over the next like 8-9 months, now that my head is clear from, I can wash D.B. Cooper away a little bit and put LSD research in its place. And actually, Teddy and I are talking about doing the same kind of arrangement for this project. And so, you know, and just, I don't know, going to coffee and, you know, trying not to wake up too early. I don't know.
All important goals.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, we were really happy to have you here at Coho.
Cool.
And it's
thank
a
you.
Great world premiere.
Yeah.
And good luck with everything that comes next.
Yeah, thank you.